You're listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flukiger, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello there, and welcome to this show, LA Talk Radio, Your Ultimate Life, the show dedicated completely to helping you create a life of purpose, prosperity, and joy. Today, I have a special guest with me. He's going to talk about all kinds of things that makes your life better, Dr. Sam Shea. Sam, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here, Colin.
I'm excited to have you. So we were just chatting in the green room, and you asked me the question I get all the time, which is, gee, what are we going to talk about today? And I said, yeah, there's some very specific things that I'm not going to tell you. And of course, as a comedian, you would appreciate that answer. Mm-hmm. But I want to ask
I'm being pre-heckled here for those of us listening. This is what's happening. I'm being pre-heckled.
Pre-heckled, he is. Well, he's a comedian. So, Sam, I want you to tell me about your comedy. I want to know first why you got into comedy, what it's about, and I don't do introductions, you know that, and it'll come out as we talk, but you're cool or you wouldn't be here. So tell me about your comedy.
Kellen says I'm cool. I can retire now. All right. I got into comedy. The normal way, through tragedy. So when I was 6 years old, my parents had a really horrible divorce called a nuclear divorce, where me and my sisters were caught in the blast radius, and they did everything wrong, weaponizing the kids against each other, more consumed about getting back at each other as opposed to taking care of their kids' needs. I had to retreat to the sitcoms, starting at age six, growing all the way up through high school, to get some semblance of understanding how the world worked. School was very rough, and lots of bullying, physical, verbal, and it was a lot of distress at school and a lot of emotional distress at home. And so I watched sitcoms to better understand how to get some humor and some levity in my life. But I also did it in retrospect to try to understand human behavior, because I was born with I'm on the spectrum. I was born with a form of autism called Asperger's syndrome, and I wasn't really born with social software. And I was studying sitcoms like an anthropologist. A sitcom literally means situational comedy, where you have the same cast of characters with the same personality, and they're thrown into different situations every week or so, however, whatever the iteration of the show is. So whether it's like Family Matters with Carl Winslow and Urkel, or The Simpsons is technically a sitcom, Married with Children is a very ironic kind of upside down sitcom, Seinfeld is a sitcom, and Bill the Cosby Show, of course, is a sitcom. And before anyone knew any better, we all thought he was America's dad. And I would watch these sitcoms. And what it turned out was I began to understand people better, because created this kind of archetypal roster of personalities. Like, oh, this person's acting like this person on this sitcom, this person on that person, etc. Even things like Saturday morning cartoons, whether you're watching Batman or X-Men or other things, these are all kind of archetypal characters. And comedy, I learned that comedy was a great way to communicate subtle and explicit truths. That the easiest way to deliver something that's difficult is through a sense of humor and laughter. As someone much wiser once said, laughter is the closest distance between two people. And comedy became a way for me to communicate, and also a way for me to diffuse tense situations. I learned also that people were less prone to bully me if I made them laugh. Now, if that sounds like a pretty sad origin story, well, you don't know many comics, do you? So yeah. The comedy became at first a way to understand the world. Then it was a way to communicate with the world. Now it's become a way to affect the world. And I now write comedy in a very specific way, modeled after Jim Gaffigan and Jerry Seinfeld. A clean, observational, well-written, witty, intelligent humor that's on a topic that's meaningful. Although you can say Jerry's humor has always been on the nothing, you know, literally like his show is about nothing. That was his tagline.
Right.
I have a 1 hour show that's available for free on YouTube called Neurospicy Love, Life and Comedy on the Spectrum. Neurospicy Love, Life and Comedy on the Spectrum. And that comedy's now become my advocacy and my education work. And the 1 hour show is the 1 hour I wish I had seen and my whole family had seen and my community and the teachers and the school, and my friends and everyone else around me 40 years ago to help explain how a spectrum mind works and how to better navigate and support someone on who has that particular brain makeup. And it's not an antagonistic show. There's no cursing. There's no politics. There's no gratuitous body fluid jokes. It's designed to bring people together. And it's funny, if I do say so myself, and you learn a lot, and it's about a very meaningful topic. And so I'm now working my way through multiple different topics over the next 10 years. I am continuing to build out a show about once every 2-3 years on a specific topic that's very meaningful to me. The next one I'm working on right now is on what it's like to grow up with a lot of chronic illness and how I came out of being chronically ill as a child and how I became a functional medicine practitioner. And then I have another one on addiction that I'm working on because I had a sugar and a video game addiction, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the comedy has become comedy's helped me quite literally transmute pain into purpose.
So I love that. And thank you for that wonderful description. I like when you said it was first a way to understand and then communicate and now affect change. I can say to the audience, I've watched the Neurospicy show that he's got on YouTube, and I find it funny. And what it teaches me again, and I knew this, but is that we don't have to have things that are offensive in order to be funny. They're it's good, and I really like it, so I absolutely endorse it. I have a question.
In defense of other comics, like I chose the no cursing, no politics as a stylistic choice that's authentic to me. I don't mind people comic. There's at least a dozen different styles of comedians out there. I only just want them to do it well. If you took cursing away from Eddie Murphy, that would be an actual crime. If you took it away from multiple, there's so many comics that cursing is an absolute integrated part of their. So is politics. So is body fluid jokes. Whatever. I'm not doing this because I'm quote better than them. Not at all. It's a stylistic choice that's authentic to me, and I want more high quality stand up comedians that are authentic and do it well. So just for those of you who are may have your fur up, it was like, wait a minute, you can't curse as a comic? Of course you can. Just do it well.
All right. So practice your cursing and do it well.
Exactly.
So my question, you said something about bullying, and a lot of people who, you know, this show, Your Ultimate Life, it's about how to create a life of purpose, prosperity, and joy, which you model in terms of how you affect people, how you relate to people, and so forth. And your journey to become a functional medicine practitioner is quite interesting, and we'll get into some of that. What was the cause? Was it the Asperger's that was principally the issue of bullying, or was there something else? Because you mentioned chronic illness and some other things. So what was the cause of that?
The cause of the illness?
No, the cause of the bullying. It's
cause of bullying. Oh, sure. Children are feral. It's Lord of the Flies. I don't feel. Someone once told me once that children are innocent but not good. That when you even when you look at neurologically, like the frontal lobes are not fully developed, that would inhibit, you know, our more animalistic instincts here. And there's a couple of factors that led to the bullying. One, I wasn't really born with social software, so I would constantly miss social cues because I'm on the autistic spectrum, and that's just a reality being born that way. And and kids can be quite cruel, and like if I just had this bad habit of believing what people literally said. So children will say, I'll be your best friend, or oh, you know, if you do this, this will happen, or if you do this, this won't happen. And I would just believe them. Like people would bullies would come up to me and tell me like some terrible thing happened, and I would believe them, or that if I didn't do something that I would get in trouble or whatnot. And or just the gang of them would just come up to me and jump me and literally just start assaulting me. Oh, I'm sorry. And the difference between, and for those listening, like says, oh, come on, it's, you know, just a bit of bullying. Like, what's the difference? Here's a riddle for you, Colin. What's the difference between bullying, physical bullying and assault?
I don't know, so I'm not going to pretend.
The difference is if you're over 18 and out of school, it's assault. And if you're under 18 and still in school, they call it bullying.
Oh, okay. It's
a distinction without a difference. Bullying is a way to sanitize violent tendencies in schools in order to cover them up and to minimize their impact. And yes, there may be less, in theory, less physical injury simply because kids are still, a lot of them are mostly collagen and we don't have a lot of martial arts training under our belts and the impact is a lot less, but it's still violence. And the problem was I grew up in a school that was quite tolerant of physical violence and thought, and a parental and a community that didn't believe me or thought I was attention seeking, you know, and I was just basically being gaslit by my parents and by the community. And then because I felt I had no support and I kept missing social cues, the bullies quickly figured out that I was an easy target. And right. Then I developed insomnia and anxiety and depression. And then the insomnia, I never had a growth spurt because of I was so stressed out from everything at school and at home. So if you're also consistently the shortest and frailest and sickest kid in the school, you're basically school is like the Serengeti. You know, apex predators go pick off smaller prey, and I was the smallest prey in the school. And so it just kind of kept feeding on itself. And my sense is that the people I am most upset with are not necessarily the kids. I'm upset with the adults in the room who fail to intervene and fail to take a child's plea for help seriously. To me, primarily the fault falls on the school and my parents and the adults, especially the adult children of my assailants.
Yeah. So okay, that's good. And I'm thankful you sharing all that. So I'm now having this picture of the Serengeti and all of the things that happened to you. Yet here we are a few minutes later. Well, a few decades, I get it. But you know, here you are, capable, functional, a very educated and powerful practitioner. And we'll get into some of that in a minute. Like when did you get the ability or develop the wherewithal? Because, you know, social cue software probably didn't download. I guess you can learn it over time. I don't really know, but you can tell me that. But what happened to give you the wherewithal to manage this situation that happened, what, all the way through high school?
Yeah, high school. It's all the way through the end of high school.
Okay, so what happened?
So the primary reason I've been able to endure and still keep on a path of trying to help reduce suffering in the world, as opposed to a path of vengeance or despair or neglect or just simply disappear, is because I had one person in my life from the beginning who demonstrated, didn't talk about it, but demonstrated, lived a life of meaning and loving kindness. And that was my nanny, and her name was Brady. And she, despite all of the darkness that was happening in school, at home, she was the one bright light in my life that was consistent and unwavering. Brady was a first-generation Irish immigrant with no formal education. In fact, her first language wasn't even English. It was Gaelic. And she just glowed with loving kindness. And she was a deeply, deeply, deeply religious person, but never once talked about it. She did not ever try to convert. She never preached. Nothing. All she did was just glow and radiate the love and kindness that she lived by, where most people just talk about scripture in one way, but live a completely different way. She was the complete opposite. She completely lived it, but never spoke about it. And so she was the person that proved to me that there is love and kindness and goodness in this world. And it is not predicated on education. It's not predicated on any type of status. It's not predicated on any on anything except what's in your heart and how you live your life and how you treat people and the way you walk in the world. And Bridie, I mean, I've held on to the quiet lessons I've learned from Bridie with two hands at many dark moments in my life. And she is the one that kept me moving forward, that it is worth it to keep going and to keep to find a way that I could be of service to those who are also struggling in the darkness, whether it's the darkness of anxiety, of emotional, you know, being emotionally distraught, to physically unwell, to whatever it might be. In my own unique way, how can I be a light in the world? And just even to radiate a fraction of what Bridie's glow was, I would consider be a meaningful, fulfilling life.
You know, something you've said, all right, go, you finish.
No,
go ahead.
I'll stop
there. All right. So I want to observe something and I want to get your reaction to it. We look around us and we see struggles. We see anger and prejudice and, you know, the list of things that we see is long. And people say, well, I can't do anything. Well, I'm just one person. Well, this, well, that. And they have a lot of excuses and reasons why it doesn't really matter that they don't try or do anything because they can't do anything anyway. And yet you've given me a story and the subsequent example, you know, given what you have just said about her individual love, radiation, not uranium, but, you know, radiating light and love, right? And how, the effect that it has on you, and she is one person. So I want you to talk for just a minute about, I mean, you did, but I want you to say just a little bit more about the power that one single person has to add good to the world, to make a real difference.
When I reflect back on my life, there are singular individuals that really stand out. And singular individuals have made very strong imprints on me, for good or ill. And I think when I look back at how I want to live my life, I would like to not emulate the very people that I experience as who hurt me. I want to do the opposite of that. So I want to take on whatever they taught me as a cautionary tale, like to not do those things, and then to be more like the people who are singular, who had a good influence on me, who were good people in their own way. And some people were flawed vessels. Other people were way less flawed, like, in my opinion, Bridie. And it's very rare that a singular individual influences, you know, thousands, 10,000s, and millions of people. And I think there is a mythology that through whatever our you know, we all grew up with Joseph Campbellian journeys of, you know, the hero goes out and makes this big mark on the world and the land is forever changed and all the rest of this. I mean, I come from a lens of evolutionary psychology. It's like our brains evolved in bands of 75 to approximately 150 people. And it was extremely rare for anybody to influence anyone beyond that band of 75 to 150 people. And I believe that it's one person, I think in our own life. If I hold the framework of that 75 to 150 people that I can influence and be a part of as a tribe, I feel like that's a number that is easier and more realistic for us to meaningfully influence. Bridie significantly influenced me. I have no idea if she really significantly influenced other people outside of me. I have no idea. I literally have no idea. I know her children, her husband. But I think it's a little bit grandiose for so many people to not start. What is it called? Grandiose in some sort of inverted way. I don't want to start because I know I won't be able to affect enough people. How about just affecting one person? How about just start there? Like not everyone's going to be an influencer, you know, and yes, your blog post or your Instagram reached a million people as if that's going to be massively life-changing anyway. I think what's happening now with the expansion of digital reach, there's now going to be a higher currency on analog impact. What people I think is a healthier way to strive is, can I make a deeper, more meaningful impact on one person and then let that ripple out as opposed to trying to spread a wider net?
Right. And it's superficial. A more superficial way. Right. So I want to go now to, I get that and I love it because it's given me exactly what I want now. You have made a particular effort to be very capable and very educated and very learned in the things that you do, mm-hmm. as indicated by the, you know, the letters you have behind your name. And now we're going to go into, okay, let's go right down that road. Sam believes, and I support you, that it's more important to have a deep and meaningful impact on a few, even starting with one, and than it is to worry about trying to reach zillions. So let's go down that road and talk about how you do that now, because with her help and light, you were able to keep trying. At some point, she wasn't in your life as much directly as she was when you grew up. And then you've gone on now to do amazing things and things that are really important because you are able to sort of keep going. So talk about where you have gone after that encouragement and fuel that moved you forward.
Sure. So my journey's taken me through a lot of chronic illness as a child, and in my journeys to try to get myself out of it, I found a real, when it was out of necessity, I went into natural medicine. And both my parents were medical doctors, and in the 80s, they didn't know anything about nutrition. And I was given the absolute wrong diet, the wrong health advice, everything. And it's one reason why I never had a growth spurt and I was so sick. And to them, the answer to everything was SSRIs, TV, and emotional neglect. And like that was the parenting you got in the 80s. And because I was so unwell, in high school, I found out about something called natural medicine, and through a book and then through, a mentor that I met in later high school. And I decided to pivot to go into natural medicine as opposed to become the third generation medical doctor. So when I got into studying, holistic health, I went out to chiropractic school. I then went on to become a functional neurologist and then got an acupuncture degree and then studied with an osteopath when I lived abroad and then got really heavy into functional medicine with the Kalish Institute and the Institute for Functional Medicine and then got really heavy into functional genetics through Fit Genes. What I learned was that I just kind of put together all these different pieces from all these different avenues around natural health, from structure to nutrition to mind-body medicine and so on. And the ways that I found that are going to be the most empowering to individuals is giving people not a shiny new toy, like here's a supplement or here's a device or whatever. Instead, what people really need is a roadmap, a framework, a blueprint, is a way to understand themselves And then all the other toys and shiny objects and nutrients, whatever it might be, those are great as long as they're applied in your particular situation for the duration that you need it, as opposed to just, oh, this thing sounds good, I'll just buy it and try it. And the most impactful thing that I can give people is their own personal roadmap, their own personal framework, that they can then answer the questions for themselves and then use, just go by the data. You know, a lot of people, if you're trying to run a business, you need to have data, your metrics, your numbers. Health is the same way. And the way to best understand functional medicine or holistic medicine, it's the best of Western medicine's lab diagnostics with the best of natural medicine's lifestyle, diet, nutrition, interventions. And when we look at frameworks and blueprints, the really simple way to understand is that you want a framework or blueprint for a lifestyle and a framework or blueprint for labs. Lifestyle is looking at you from the outside in. What are your sleeping habits, what are your eating habits, what your morning and evening routines, exercise, stress reduction, your posture, hydration, are exposed to mold or other environmental chemicals or whatever it might be. Looking at yourself from the outside in is lifestyle. Labs is looking at you from the inside out. What do the numbers actually say? You know, whether it's gut testing or hormone testing or metabolism testing or testing for toxic metals or things like that, or testing genetics. So if you have those two frameworks in mind, lifestyle and labs, then you combine them together. Congratulations, that's holistic medicine. Those are the two halves of holistic medicine, lifestyle and labs. And I put together my own frameworks for both lifestyle and labs. But just as a broader message for people who are out there wanting to work with a practitioner, you'd want to ask them, what's your framework for assessing someone's lifestyle and what's your framework for assessing someone's labs? And if they don't have a framework, you might want to move on and to find someone who does. And if once you have a framework, then you can save so much time, money, energy, and attention. Because now you're not wasting time and spinning your wheels just hoping you find some random thing that might help you.
So I'm going to ask you a question about that, because you and I talked before. You are in my other show, and I recommend everybody here go look up my podcast. And Sam was a guest there, and his episode either is out or will be out soon. It doesn't matter. Find him. Look it up on Spotify or Apple or wherever. That was the first time that I heard you say what you just now said. And this is a case of you as an expert know so much that you use phrases and words that for maybe I'm the stupidest person in the audience. I don't know. But let's just say that it went over other people's head. You talk about labs. And the only exposure I've had to labs is if I go to the doctor and he gives me a requisition and he says, go get some blood work. And sometimes he'll check off periodically. He'll check off, you know, the prostate screening, or he'll check off, you know, C-reactive protein because of infections or whatever. And, you know, that's it. And so I want you to wax a little poetic, maybe because it's useful for me, but I'll bet there's somebody, group of people right now that are hearing this and saying it would be great to have a framework. And lifestyle, at least, is something that people are more conversant with, you know, the externalities around you, how well you sleep and your light and the noise and the environment and so forth. Talk a little bit about this other half.
Okay, so with labs, to understand labs, we have to look at, believe it or not, medical philosophy. So we have Western medicine medical philosophy, which is the philosophy is emergency care, that Western medicine was created on the battlefield, triage, World War I, where is it an emergency or not? Are you in crisis or not? Are you going to lose a limb or function or your life or not? If not, go over there. That's literally what triage came from. And so the philosophy of Western medicine is ideal for getting people from crisis to stable. from crisis to stability. That's Western medicine philosophy. That's really great in emergencies. It's not as great when it's applied to someone who's wanting to go from chronic to normal, and certainly from normal to optimal. So we have one philosophy for emergency care, from crisis to stability. The other philosophy is in holistic medicine, functional medicine, natural medicine, whatever you want to call it. That's the philosophy of, can I help you get from chronic to normal, normal to optimal? That philosophy does not work in the emergency room. So the sandbox of someone's health is quite big. You've got the emergency side of the sandbox, and you've got the chronic to normal, normal to optimal. Now, when you look at labs, when you look at the same lab, there's the same bell curve of where you said CRP as an example, and you got a number from one number to another number. Now, Western medicine, they're looking for, is that number out of range? And that is more in the emergency, okay, is it out of range? If it's not out of range, actually, let me put it something better than CRP. Let's pick TSH. That's the thyroid stimulating hormone. That's a very frequent one people come across if they're not feeling well, and then they're not feeling well, and they have all these signs of thyroid issues, and then they go to an endocrinologist or GP, and all they test is TSH, and says, your TSH is normal, you're fine, go home until it's bad enough, then come back, we'll retest it, and when it's bad enough, we'll put you on a medication. Okay, that philosophy right there is Western emergency care thinking, where your number falls within this range, therefore it's not an emergency, therefore we're triaging you to go and wait till it's bad enough. So then when it is bad enough, now we're going to treat you with emergency tools like a drug surgery or whatever it is. So then you go to functional medicine and you have the same range of TSH. Now in Western medicine, the range is usually somewhere, some labs differ from one to another. So, but in round numbers, it's 0.5 to 5. Okay. In functional medicine, the range, and numbers vary a little bit between some organizations, but it's basically the range is not 0.5 to 5, it's 0.5 to 2 and 0.5 to 2.5 in people over 65. So from a functional medicine standpoint, you can have, you look at the exact same numbers, but to you, you're looking at that gray space in the bell curve where it may be, quote, normal, but it's certainly not optimal. Normal means it's within the medical normals, but it doesn't mean it's functionally optimal. And a lot of people are stuck in this kind of purgatory of, my numbers are technically normal, they're within the medical ranges, but I don't feel normal, I don't feel good. And when I go and I get tested in a Western medical mindset, they tell me that my numbers are fine, go home, and if you need to, here's an antidepressant.
So I'm absolutely certain there's a bunch of people listening right now that are nodding their heads and saying they have been sent home and patted on the head when they know that something isn't right. Like, I personally know people, so keep going, because
that was this entire story of my childhood through my teenage years, was my parents gaslighting me. And they were medical doctors, and I kept trying to communicate that things were very wrong, and all I got was, take an SSRI and stop bothering us. And like, you're fine. Your numbers are fine. Your life is fine. And it's clearly like it was. And so I'm deeply sensitive to people being told that their experiences, their lived experience is invalid. But in one sense, I don't blame the Western medical doctors, is because they're trained on how to interpret those numbers in that specific mindset. And again, that mindset is brilliant for the emergency room. It's absolutely brilliant. It's perfect. You should have that mindset. Is it an emergency or not? Doesn't really work so well outside the emergency room. So to go into the labs, now that we understand the kind of overarching differences in the philosophies, emergency versus functional. So now if we're talking about, when you go to, you go get your CRP, you go get your prostate numbers or whatever it might be, then it's like, if it's within the bell curve, you're fine, you're sent home. Okay, now we're going to switch over to what the type of labs that I'm talking about.
Good.
So in the functional lab world, when you go to say you go get a gut test. Now, a gut test in the Western medical world, so here's like the 10 to 12 infections you get if you can get traveler's diarrhea, and we're looking for those things. In a functional test, you usually get a test that's checking for several dozens of those infections, plus all the beneficial, the major keystones, rather, of the beneficial bacteria. And you're looking at gut digestion markers, like how well is your pancreas working? How well is your gallbladder working? You're looking for markers for gut inflammation, the gut immune system. Do you have antibodies to gluten that are attacking, inside your gut? Do you have markers for intestinal permeability, colloquially called leaky gut? Do you have markers checking for how well you're navigating your immune system inside your gut? So it's much more comprehensive. We're looking at way, 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 way more things and getting a much bigger picture. If we're testing thyroid, we're not just testing TSH. We're looking at several other markers that go along with TSH, like free T3, free T4, reverse T3, antibodies to the thyroid. The two of the biggest, most important ones are anti-TPO and anti-TG antibodies. I mean, if you want me to spell them out, I can, but that's only just going to make
no. That's fine. Scrabble. No, don't.
Yeah, it's just Scrabble words. Don't worry about them. So you can see the difference is like there's over here, there's just TSH in Western, but over here in the functional, you've got all these other ones as well that we're looking at. If you're testing genetics, a medical genetics test, it's looking like, do you have trisomy 21 or Huntington's disease, or like, we're looking for very specific quote unquote disease genes. But in the functional genetics space, we're not looking necessarily for disease genes. We're looking at all the genes about inflammation, like the top dozen to dozen and a half most important genes for inflammation. Because if those get provoked through poor lifestyle choices, then those genes are going to create a lot of excessive inflammation, which will then poke on the quote unquote disease genes downstream. I'm interested in genetics from a higher level of what are the drivers of diseases of the genes beneath them. Because there's things above disease genes. Inflammation, the genes of inflammation, the genes of protecting free radicals, protecting the mitochondria from free radicals, the genes of liver detox, the genes of using vitamin D, the genes of methylation. Like there's more important genes to look at than just merely the disease genes themselves. Not to say those aren't important in certain cases to know about, but let's not ignore the most important genes above. Additionally, in genetics, there's genes around diet. So growing up, I had a coffee habit starting at age 6 to keep me awake because I was so exhausted from the insomnia starting at age 6. Now, wow. I didn't learn until 36 that I was genetically vulnerable to caffeine-induced anxiety and depression. I'll say that again. Caffeine-induced anxiety and depression. I literally just recorded an hour plus podcast that I'm going to be releasing the Fit Genes podcast sometime in June, just on caffeine sensitivity, of which I have massive caffeine sensitivity. Now, here's a perfect case of how sometimes anxiety and depression is physiological, not psychological. Caffeine in certain people like me can trigger lots of anxiety and then rebound depression. Now, growing up, I had anxiety and depression. And I was told it's all in my head and I just need to take an SSRI, as opposed to looking at what are the environmental issues, whether it's bullying at school, severe insomnia, or coffee. And the one reason I'm so passionate about genetics testing in particular is because anyone can get it at any age, it's just a cheek swab. And you've got the data for life. So it's the most high value test out there because the data doesn't decay in value over time. Like here is your genetic template. But if I had known at age 6, all of my genetics that I learned at 36, my entire life would have been completely different. My health would have been different. My height would have been different. My level of vitality would have been different. The struggle would have been a fraction of it was to get through all of my health challenges. I would have avoided so many of my health challenges. I would have had so much clarity and saved so much time, energy, money, and effort and attention if I had known my genetics. Just getting off of coffee alone, that would have massively changed my life. Other things you can learn about your diet is, like, what's your carb tolerance? Are you genetically more sensitive or genetically more suited for keto, paleo, Mediterranean, or a higher carb diet? We can stop arguing about diet and start testing. You can genetically test what your relationship is to alcohol, to histamine, to lactose, to many other things. And you can also genetically test for what your optimal exercise type is. Are you a fast twitch, a slow twitch, intermediate, meaning are you better at sprinting, endurance, somewhere in between? Are you genetically vulnerable to joint injuries because if your collagen genes are weaker, or you get more inflammation, so you're more prone to exercise-induced injuries? So if you've got those genes for collagen and inflammation issues, that doesn't mean don't exercise. It means you really have to focus as much on recovery as you do the exercise. And that'll be really, really, really good to know if that's just genetically what you got, that those are the cards you were dealt. And so I'm going to reality. I want to know.
I totally agree with you. We've got about 10 minutes left, and I want to get from that spectacular information. And the key piece that you said is, if I had known this, my whole life would have been different. Now, you have not chosen to be mad about it and run around and blame people and stomp up and down, but instead you've chosen to make information and these kinds of tests and stuff available. I have two questions. The first is, why does there still seem to be such, and maybe I'm wrong, tell me if I'm wrong, but a competition or a disdain or lack of cooperation between those branches of medicine that function well for triage and going from busted to at least more or less okay, and the people like you that are working on optimization? Why does that feel so, still at least to me, a bit of, you know, antagonism? What's going on there?
I think part of it's generational, Kellen. I mean, that there is still there is still the era of, you know, there's still a generational antagonism, but I think the younger generation of health practitioners are much more interested in collaboration and integrative work than the people who were trained in the 60s, 70s, and 80s and 90s.
So how many more years is it going to take before that takes care of itself?
There's a very macabre phrase that science advances one death at a time. And that comes from the physicists, because there's a lot of physics that can't be explored until the hierarch of the, like, everyone's waiting for Michio Kaku to kick the bucket so we can move on from string theory. I mean, that's an open secret. Everyone's just waiting for him to die, you know, like, and so the same thing is in medicine. There's some real stalwarts who are in charge of very powerful and profitable organizations in Western medicine that don't like competition for power, for their pocketbook, or for their prestige. And everyone also has their own lived experience of having good or bad experiences with different branches of medicine. Like, my grandfather was a famous medical doctor. He was probably one of the most famous gastroenterologists in the United States. He was the founding director of the Fells Cancer Research Center at Temple University in 1936 and published over 300 articles. And he died on the operating table from medical malpractice under the knife of his colleagues. Now, my mother had her life both saved by an emergency operation, and she also almost died from having an operation where the surgeon forgot to tie the knot around the artery. She almost bled out to death. So it's, and then people have gone to non-Western medicine, and some of them have had massive transformative experiences, and others have had very, very expensive journey through something that didn't work for them. And sometimes they didn't get the right thing, and they had an adverse experience. So you have people's lived experiences, both positive and negative, that get amplified through institutions that then, through either they want to shut down the competition, or they want to shut down something they think that's dangerous, or possibly a bit of both, or maybe it's a bit of bias or whatever it might be. You've got human incentives amplified by power and prestige and also personal grievances. And I think the tide is shifting. It's shifting in one direction, but it's also polarizing at the ends. And you only have to look at what happened 5 years ago to see just how quickly people polarized into one medical camp or the other. And I do see that as this next generation of practitioners in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s see what's happening to their parents and grandparents' generation, and they're like, I don't want to end up like that. And
right.
There was one particular dominant medical paradigm that had them end up like that, the neurodegeneration and other things. Like, I think that there might be a different way that we can leverage, like I said before, the best of Western medicine's lab diagnostics with the best of natural medicine's lifestyle, diet, nutrition, interventions. Functional medicine is the future of medicine, where we combine the best of the technological toys with the best of lifestyle, diet, nutrition, interventions, and also have access to wonderful emergency care.
Right.
And we can actually have the best of both worlds.
So I want to take this moment now to give you plenty of time to talk about, because I know for sure there's people that are thinking, I want this best of both worlds. And you mentioned a couple of the labs and the detail, like the 36 things instead of 12, and that kind of thing. I don't know about anybody else, but that excites me. So where do people go right now to listen to, I know your NeuroSpices on YouTube, but mm-hmm. to find out more of the medical stuff that to explore this, like where do they go to find out more about you, or to mm-hmm. find out more about functional medicine, if that's the future of medicine, or to, if they're excited about the idea from going from chronic to normal, normal to optimal. Like, what does somebody need to do mm-hmm. right now when we hang up the phone here?
Sure. So if people want to learn more about whatever specific topic you're interested in, natural health or health in general, or all these the new ways of thinking, or learn more about the other stuff that I teach, simply just put my name, Dr. Sam Shay, S-A-M-S, and Shay spelled S-H-A-Y, into any podcast player or YouTube, and you'll find probably a couple hundred interviews of me on different topics. My YouTube channel, Dr. Sam Shay, has my comedy, but it has a couple of playlists on comedy, but it has like tons of playlists on genetics and thyroid and functional medicine and health and interviews going into all sorts of different topics. And if people are interested in genetics, if you're a practitioner and you want licensed practitioner or certified health coach, and you want to actually run genetics in your practice, and you want an easy way to do it that's very effective, I've created a whole new series of genetics reports that makes it really straightforward to help identify people's blueprints in diet, lifestyle, and exercise. You can go to fitgenesusa.com and register there to become a practitioner. Fitgenes, FITGENESUSA.com. And also, if you're a member of the lay public and you just want to get your genetics done, you can go to fitgenesusa.com also and click find a practitioner and put in some info. We can connect you to your nearest practitioner to then run the genetics with you. And we only offer the genetics through oversight, through practitioners, through coaches and practitioners. For people who are interested more in the functional testing side of things like gut, thyroid, mitochondria, hormones, toxins, mold, etc., you can go to my personal website, drsamshay.com, drsamshay.com. And that's where people can find more information about the functional testing. So you've got the YouTube channel, you've got FitGenesUSA, and you got drsamshay.com. Those are the three places.
Thank you. And I wanted to make sure we got that in, because when you've talked about the genes that, our predisposition to have this about this diet or that diet or mm-hmm. this sensitivity or that, that sort of thing interests me personally a lot. And I'm sure I'm not the only one. Sam, this has been very fascinating. And the thing for me at least, that's made it the most exciting is to understand how you have turned your own struggles, your ability to see what things would have been like for you and not whine about it, but to then take that knowledge and say, how can I help other people now not have the experiences that I have had? And so I really appreciate your work and what you're doing.
Thank you, Kellen. And I really appreciate the work you're doing as well. You're giving people an opportunity to share their story and to help inspire people. And if there's any, if people want to walk away from this with two things, one, be like Bridie, be someone that walks the walk and doesn't need to talk the talk, and to like transmute your pain into purpose. Mine was helping people find their frameworks for their health, but find your own and walk in that way with meaning and purpose and love and light. And even if you affect one person meaningfully, it's worth it.
I love that. Sam, thanks for being with me tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kellen.
So I want you to pay attention, especially to that last part. Look, your health is in your hands. Dr. Sam Shea and Fit Genes USA and his YouTube channel. Like, there's tons of stuff. And you can get educated and get help to get optimized. What a cool thing. Get rid of those things that have been bothering you. And, you know, there's more, like, there's so much in our lives. If we're not feeling good, if no one's paying attention to what we're saying, there's a way to fix that. And optimizing the body, optimizing the health, and now that we have more and more tools to do that, is such a powerful foundation for you to move forward and create your ultimate life.
You're listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flukiger, only on LA Talk Radio.